Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's Reality Cast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of Reality Cast, Catherine Cross will explain why attacks on transgender people's healthcare access are so misguided. Anti-choicers use the term anchor baby to attack women for having babies, and the Ashley Madison leak has some interesting lessons about the internal politics of the Christian right. Bernie Sanders included some thoughts on women's rights at a recent rally in New Hampshire.
But all of you know what they mean by family values. And what they mean by family values is that the women of this country should not have the right to control their own bodies. I disagree.
I am wondering if one side effect of Republicans moving to the right on this issue is that Democrats, in turn, are getting blunter about what they mean when they say they are pro-choice. Last week, I reported on Republican politicians who are really, really upset at women not having babies. So upset, in fact, that both Mike Huckabee and Rick Santorum have started to suggest that the president should just ignore the Supreme Court and ban abortion by fiat, turning himself into a dictator rather than let all these women have the power to decline motherhood if they want. But now the narrative has shifted. Now women are being demonized by various Republican candidates because they have babies.
Pregnant women are coming in to have babies simply because they can do it, then there ought to be greater enforcement. That's the legitimate side of this. Greater enforcement so that you don't have these anchor babies, as they're described, coming into the country.
Yes, that was Republican candidate Jeb Bush using, to borrow his phrasing, what is called a racial slur. Anchor babies is an offensive term to describe the children of undocumented immigrants who are born in the U.S. and under the 14th Amendment to the Constitution granted automatic citizenship. But now Donald Trump is running around denying this, instead arguing that the children born to parents who immigrated here without all the legal documentation should not be citizens. He claims that they are quote-unquote anchor babies, that their mothers are having them specifically to create a legal rationale to stay here. There's no truth to it. It's just a conspiracy theory used to justify a racist belief that white people are somehow more American than people with Latino heritage, which is why I consider the term anchor baby to be a racial slur. But it's also a misogynist slur, because the whole point of the term is to demonize women in particular for having children. Yes, the same people who just minutes ago were denouncing women for not having babies turn around and denounce women for having babies. The common theme here is that because you are a woman, everything you do is wrong, and because you are a woman, your body is public property to be controlled by a bunch of angry conservatives because reasons. Bush is backtracking hard from the term now that journalists are calling him out.
Do you worry that using the term anchor babies could affect your ability to win the Hispanic vote?
No, look, as I said in Spanish, my background, my life, the fact that I'm immersed in the immigrant experience, This is ludicrous for the Clinton campaign and others to suggest that somehow I'm using a derogatory term. What I was talking about was the specific case of fraud being committed where there's organized efforts, and frankly it's more related to Asian people coming into our country, having children, in that organized efforts, taking advantage of a noble concept with his birthright citizenship. I support the 14th Amendment.
Well, sort of. He still endorses this bizarre conspiracy theory, but instead blames Asian immigrants for it. It's still nonsense. Having a child who is a citizen is not actually very good prevention for a deportation, as the children of thousands of families broken up because their parents got deported could tell you. Bush is in a weird position. He wants to be seen as a reasonable candidate who doesn't truck with this misogynist racist abuse towards Latinas, but he also wants Fox News viewers to vote for him. And Fox News loves the fact that Donald Trump will fling around terms like anchor babies.
All these controversies have helped him because people are so sick of people having to apologize and cry and bow and scrape when they say something that's notionally offensive to the PC crowd.
So far, everything that has been thrown at Trump is not, nobody has found kryptonite for Donald Trump so far.
Now, Geraldo, you just heard the truth uttered. Whatever, I'm sure you're not like a huge Trump guy,
But aren't you a little sick of having to measure every single word to meet a series of rules you didn't write? Here's a guy who says exactly what he thinks, he doesn't care, and there's something thrilling about that, no?
You mean like anchor baby?
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean.
All right, we'll get into that.
That's Tucker Carlson loving the term anchor babies, even as Geraldo Rivera seemed a little more sour about it. But this whole just telling it like it is nonsense is being used frequently to defend this term in right-wing media.
All right, let me go to the issue that came up. Hillary Clinton comes out with an ad, you know, excoriating Donald Trump for daring to use the term anchor baby, which is a justifiable term. If Trump fires right back at a reporter who also wants him to stop using that term. What other term, Charles? There is no other term to use.
This is a guy, may I remind you, who loves getting weepy and sentimental about embryos. Embryos, people. But if you're an actual born person, as long as your parents are immigrants, you barely rate as a person in his eyes. I don't even really want to call that hypocrisy. He's definitely consistent in his belief that whatever women are doing with their bodies, it's probably wrong and the law should punish them for it. Don't want a baby? Too bad, he wants to force you. Having a baby? Too bad, he wants to strip that baby of citizenship rights. It's worth remembering that Sean Hannity's grandparents were Irish immigrants, so, by his own reckoning, his own parents are, quote-unquote, anchor babies. But of course he doesn't see it like that, because no matter how conservatives like to frame it, this is about race and nothing else. I'd like to welcome Catherine Cross, who is a sociologist and PhD student at CUNY Graduate Center in New York City, specializing in research on online harassment and gender in virtual worlds. She's written a piece for RH Reality Check about access to medical care for trans people, and she's here today to talk about it. Thanks so much for coming on to RealityCast, Catherine.
Thank you so much for having me, Amanda. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so what's with the New York Times publishing these concerned trolling articles about trans women? I don't get it.
Sometimes I wish I got it, but no, the underlying issue here is just that they believe erroneously that there's a debate to be had about whether or not we should have rights and what those rights should look like, and that we ought not be part of that conversation because we're too biased. They've been publishing a few op-eds, as you've alluded to, that are meant to be sort of contrarian pieces that, from the perspective of their cisgender authors, buck what they perceive to be the tide of acceptance that trans people are now benefiting from. And at the heart of that is the argument in Friedman's piece, which is that we should be more skeptical, quote unquote, of trans people's claims to rights and equal access to healthcare, as if that quote unquote skepticism does not define our interactions with cisgender people practically every day of our lives.
And the article specifically that you're talking about is a piece by Richard Friedman, and you wrote a piece at RH Reality Check debunking him and rebutting a piece he wrote for the New York Times. What was his specific argument?
So he tried a, as you pointed out, concern trolling approach, but it was something that was meant to look like he was accepting and tolerant of trans people and was adopting a middle-of-the-road perspective where he said, yes, that you can change your gender. We should be more accepting. Gee, isn't it terrible that trans people are experiencing such violence? But we should stop believing them automatically whenever they say they're trans or whenever they need X, Y, and Z bits of medical health care. That we should, as I said earlier, be skeptical of trans people's claims to affirming healthcare, and that we actually don't know what works and what doesn't, and we don't know what trans people really need. So we shouldn't take them at face value until we sort it all out. That's really the thrust of his argument. And he engages in more of the moral panicking about young trans people, about prepubescent and teenage trans children who demand access to hormone blockers and HRT and things like that, and advances the argument again that we definitely should not take those children seriously and cast a scornful eye of skepticism on their claims because they don't know what they really want and they end up being cisgender anyway. So that's really where he was going with this, that we should be skeptical of trans people's claims to access healthcare.
Specifically, there was this question of whether or not we should consider a study that said that rates of suicide were the same pre and post gender reassignment surgery. Why was his argument on that reductive and misleading?
The argument was misleading because the study did not have controls that allowed it to present the conclusions that Friedman drew from it. So it compared transgender people that had sexual reassignment surgery to a cisgender control group, which really does not say much of anything in terms of the effectiveness of SRS in terms of reducing suicidal ideation and other depression comorbidities and so on. And instead, Friedman said that this nevertheless was an argument for skepticism, that surgery doesn't do everything that we supposedly want it to do, and I'll speak more about that later. But the other issue is that the researchers themselves said this study cannot be used to draw conclusions about the effectiveness of SRS. So, you know, I don't want to slam those researchers too much because they're the victim of someone who's misusing the data that they presented, but they put together a study that could not really be used to answer that particular question. And yet, it's the one that Friedman really hinges his argument on in the face of evidence that suggests otherwise, that he simply dismisses because it doesn't really support his argument.
And I found that to be particularly maddening, as you clearly did too, because it seems to set the baseline at what is considered appropriate medical intervention at whether or not you're going to survive or not. And I found that shouldn't there be more for what we expect out of medical care?
Yes, I mean, it's a fundamentally dehumanizing argument because this sort of argument is generally only made about transgender people. That whenever we hear about a transgender suicide, particularly one that's relatively prominent, immediately the concern trolls come out of the woodwork to say, see, we gave into your delusion and you still killed yourselves. This is why you're all crazy and we should stop feeding this nonsense. You're not really women, etc. Right. That notion is something that is never applied to other kinds of healthcare. We don't think that treatments that reduce the risk of heart disease have failed if a person dies from a heart attack in their 70s, because it prevented them probably from dying in their 40s or 50s. You know, we accept that there's a bell curve here. There are issues of mitigating and minimizing harm and risk. And also, on top of everything else, it's unfortunate that this needs to be said out loud, but we are human. We sometimes suffer, and oftentimes do suffer, from a variety of mental health and physical health issues that have nothing to do with us being transgender. Sometimes if, you know, we are neuroatypical, that has nothing to do with us being trans. Some trans people are depressed for reasons that have nothing to do with gender transition. And so expecting SRS to be a cure-all for that, which is, you know, one of many distinctions that the Swedish study that Friedman hinges his argument on didn't make, in expecting a cure-all to come from SRS is ridiculous. And most trans people have a realistic understanding of what to expect from SRS. We expect it to relieve a certain amount of physical revulsion and discomfort, but not to fix every part of our lives, because we also live in an oppressive society. And as I wrote in the article, Friedman acts surprised that a biomedical intervention does not fix the symptoms of a fundamentally sociological problem. And I just find that baffling.
And I found it baffling, too, because it was such a black and white approach to, and obviously you know a lot but more about this than I do, but from what I understand, there's a wide variety of interventions that can be done, and it's very individualized in the kind of care you receive. And in a lot of ways, it really is kind of, at this point, still more of an art than a science. Am I mistaken in sort of in my understanding of this?
Well, it depends on who you ask. Certainly, in terms of treatment guidelines, we do have a good medical / scientific basis for the treatments we apply. Most psychologists and other mental and physical health professionals tend to broadly agree on the WPATH standards for transgender healthcare and find them to be largely effective in terms of reducing the strain from gender dysphoria and so on. But there's plenty more research that needs to be done. Certainly, as you know, we as feminists know, the types of research questions that get asked are always political. So things that don't get researched have more to do with there being a political ideal that certain issues are not worth expending the time and energy on. And that's been true of transgender healthcare for a very long time. We only very recently had a study out of the Netherlands that demonstrated longitudinally for the first time that the hormone replacement therapy used by trans men and trans women was medically safe. We intuited that for years. There's been a certain kind of folk wisdom that has spread as a substitute for medical knowledge throughout the transgender community for the last several generations. And it's been reasonably reliable, but it's good to have a scientific backing for it now. So I suppose my point is that I would say that at this point in time, it's now more of a science than an art. But there's still a lot more that needs to be done in terms of fully understanding trans healthcare's long-term effects. My disagreement with Friedman, who does, to a modicum of credit, say that we also need more research, my disagreement with him is that he believes that the lack of research is an argument for inertia and ignoring trans people. I believe that in the absence of future research, the empirical data that we still have from trans people that have undergone a variety of medical interventions is worth something. The fact that many of us would never go back to our pre-transition selves is surely evidence of something, having worked in the interventions that we have sought out. So that's my answer to that.
As you say, one of the things that you bring up in the article that is really interesting is the data issue, because I can't, and maybe you can elucidate here, how are we supposed to collect data on outcomes for trans medical interventions if we are, as you say, employing as inertia and not actually helping people? Like, that strikes me
exactly
as a paradox.
I think that in Friedman's vision of things, there's this tiny minority of people who are true transsexual individuals that are really, as he puts it, the persisters. And so he believes probably that this group would be enough to study, and that the skepticism is meant to keep out everyone else, that all of us who are supposedly jumping on the bandwagon, because it really is how people like this tend to see it, that the so-called popularization of trans has made it a trend. And a lot of recent transitioners find themselves accused of that, of being sort of just young people who are me-tooing. But I find that to be incredibly unfair. And on top of that, also, it needs to be said that Friedman, in his article, is advancing a point of view that erases a lot of gender diversity within trans people, because not all of us need surgery, not all of us need every type of medical intervention that's associated with one gender or the other. Some people don't identify as either men or women and yet still sometimes have certain medical interventions and so on. And so yet, when he does acknowledge it, he only does so to suggest that maybe the people who claim that they need surgery don't actually need it, because there are these people out there who are living happily neo-gendered lives that didn't need surgery. So he, you know, and he leaves out the unspoken, that implication that this should delegitimize people that have somewhat more traditional binary gender transitions with full surgical accompaniments. And I find that to be immensely unfortunate. But I also feel that he, in terms of diminishing the transgender population, a lot of what happens in that article is about pretending that we don't know ourselves, simply put.
Let's end on a positive note, because you really do hit in your article a very full-throated argument in favor of scientific research and data as a way to help us better understand ourselves. What kind of research do you feel would be a good positive exploration of what directions research needs to go? What do you think that would look like?
Well, first and foremost, uterus transplants would be absolutely delightful, I think. There are so many trans women I know who dream of being able to bear their own children, and medical technology currently doesn't make that possible. We're just beginning to see the first knockings of that, but overall it's still rather distant on the horizon. And I also think that more effective surgeries for trans men wouldn't go amiss in terms of penile construction. In terms of studying medical outcomes, I would also like to see research that explored the whole transgender person rather than attributing outcomes without cause just to this or that medical intervention. Because trans people are by and large erased in a lot of this research, even when we are studied, because everything is assumed to come back to the gender question, as if we are not human beings living full lives and experiencing a wide range of influences on our mental and physical health. So I'd like to see research that actually took that into account in terms of studying trans people's mental health. Studying things like hormone replacement therapy, it certainly is easier to draw causal conclusions because that's primarily physical. But studying mental health, I think, needs to be done with a great deal more care than it has been in the past.
My guest today has been Catherine Cross. You can read her article, "There Is No Reason to Deny Trans People Necessary Medical Care," at RH Reality Check. Thank you so much for coming on to RealityCast, Catherine.
Thank you again for having me.
Earlier this summer, some hackers threatened the company Ashley Madison, a dating website that markets itself as a site for people who are looking to commit adultery. The hackers, going under the name The Impact Team, have a garbled rationalization for their action, both accusing people who sign up for the site of immorality and accusing the company of not working hard enough to delete the profiles of people who decide they want out. So they somehow simultaneously claim to be for privacy, but also want to out a bunch of would-be adulterers. It's very strange. Either way, the company was unable to meet the hackers' extremely strange and contradictory demands, and so 30-plus million user profiles were released online. It's a shame that this is happening at all, but some of the stuff that's come out has been interesting. For instance, I learned that Ashley Madison markets largely to conservative people. As Amanda Hess wrote in her Slate piece about this hack, quote, "The site stands to profit off a host of conservative social trends, closeted gay men who are afraid to come out, religious invectives against divorce, and couples marrying young before sexually experimenting with other partners," end quote. liberals cheat, absolutely, but I suspect it's because they find themselves attracted to someone specific and slide into it. The mentality of, I'm going to cheat and now it's just a matter of finding a partner, really does feel conservative, and particularly feels like the reasoning of conservative men who have a Madonna whore syndrome and want to have a relatively chaste relationship with a wife at home, but still want exciting sexual encounters outside of the home. All of which is to say is that it's therefore unsurprising whose names are being found in the data leak.
Josh Duggar is making a bombshell admission after his name appeared on a list of clients of the notorious website for cheaters, Ashley Madison. I have been the biggest hypocrite ever. While espousing faith and family values, I have secretly, over the last several years, been viewing pornography on the internet. And this became a secret addiction, and I became unfaithful to my wife.
Stay focused.
Duggar and his wife, Anna, were regulars on the now-canceled TLC reality show, 19 Kids and Counting. He's also been an outspoken advocate of family values. But according to the website Gawker, Duggar had a paid account with a controversial website for married men and women looking to have affairs.
Obviously, this story has a lot of prurient value, and I would hesitate to cover it but for the public confessions. But I think what's more interesting here is that this entire scandal doesn't just reveal the widespread hypocrisy about sex that is endemic to the Christian right. It actually reveals something darker and more sinister, which is the way that the quote-unquote family value set is, above all, about protecting and enshrining male dominance. Women are expected to be submissive on the Christian right, but they are frequently told that in exchange for that submission, they will be protected and cherished. But this scandal shows that is an empty promise. Take, for instance, the case of Sam Rader, who is a Christian vlogger whose name came up on the list. He and his wife, Nia, present themselves as this perfect Christian couple, and he even says he's the kind of man he wants his daughter to marry. But, of course, while he was saying this, he was messaging tons of women on Ashley Madison in hopes of having an affair. You will not be surprised to find out his response.
I did make the account. I made the account 2 years ago. This is an issue that is in our past. This was before I got onto YouTube. I've brought this to my church at the time when I first started the church that I'm at now. This has been brought to my discipleship partner. This was brought to my wife's attention. She has forgiven me for this mistake that I made in opening the account. I've sought forgiveness to God, and He's forgiven me. So I've been completely cleansed of this sin.
The whole selling point of the male headship, female submission thing is to tell women that if they submit to their husbands will in turn be loving, responsible men who provide spiritual leadership and just generally take responsibility for their wives and families. But, as we see, in reality, when men fail to take even basic responsibility to keep their promises, there's immense pressure on women to forgive and forget immediately. Failing to take responsibility never threatens the man's prerogative to be the leader and the authority over his wife's life. Instead, there's just automatic forgiveness and a return to a situation where he gets to be the boss no matter how bad he is at his job, just because he's a man. How nice for him. One problem is that the same Christian right that extends automatic forgiveness to male philanderers has zero forgiveness for gay people or women just being themselves, even though it doesn't hurt anyone else. On the right, it's day in and day out war on gay people or women who have sex in a fully ethical manner that doesn't involve lying or breaking promises. I don't like that this Ashley Madison leak invaded the privacy of so many people who, unlike these two, don't hold themselves out as moral leaders. But these public confessions, I think, offer an opportunity to really consider what kind of moral system they're pushing in the first place. And now for the Wisdom of Wingnuts, All Problems Are Women Having Sex edition. Dana Loesch decided that the culprit behind the recent on-air murder of two journalists in Virginia is women and their stupid health care.
We don't have a gun problem. We have a criminal problem. We have a society that thinks it's completely permissible to shirk responsibility. We have people who have no problem with what Planned Parenthood does in terms of fetal parts harvesting. We don't teach a respect for life.
It's really rich that someone who is attacking life-saving medical research as a pretext to shut off life-saving sexual health care for women would say anyone else lacks respect for life. But her insinuation that legal abortion causes crime and disregard for life is easy enough to test against statistics. The murder rate in 1972, the year before abortion was legalized nationwide, was 9 murders per 100,000 people. In 2013, it was half that at 4.5. Looks like legal abortion is teaching people to respect life. Maybe it shouldn't be so damn hard to get.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.